Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to The Churn, a podcast about Amazon's The Expanse. All of season four has now dropped, and you should watch it. But if you haven't watched it, you can still listen to this episode, which is entirely spoiler-free, unless you think it's a spoiler to know that season four brings us a new villain. He wouldn't think of himself as a villain, but I'll call him a villain, Adolphus Murtry. He is played by Bern Gorman, who nerds will recognize from such programs as Man in the High Castle, Game of Thrones, and Torchwood. He's one of this episode's guests, and we'll be getting his insights on playing bad guys, how The Expanse is like the Old West, and his relationships to other characters on the show. And sitting in on this interview is Ty Frank, who is half of James S.A. Corey, the author of The Expanse novels. He's also a writer and producer of the TV show, and he gives us a perspective on how the arrival of Murtry and the crew of the Rossi resonates through the show's new landscape. We're coming out with recap episodes soon, but until then, we have these great conversations to get you started. Again, spoiler free. I think you might need to have watched the first episode, but you can dive right in right now, no matter how much you've watched. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, and if you are so moved, rate and review us. Coming right up, an interview with Ty Frank and Bern Gorman. Bern, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And Ty, welcome to the show.
I've been on this show before.
Well, not my show. Jeez. Not my version of the show. Welcome to this season, perhaps, I should say. So speaking of welcome to my season, Bern, you are the new kid on the block this season.
Yes, and it was lots and lots of fun. We filmed up on a quarry about an hour outside of Toronto, and although I have worked in Canada before, it was a particularly violent winter, at least it was to my mind, and it really helped the character to imagine that I'm on this barren wasteland of a planet. But yeah, it was a great bunch of people, great momentum to the show, you know, with its pickup by Amazon, and Ty and the team have done a great job and a fantastic scripts.
I was going to ask you, and maybe it's cheating a little bit since Ty is there, because his backstory, Murtry's backstory, your character, it's not laid out in, as well and as clear as everyone else who we've known for, you know, years and years now. And I wonder, can you share a little bit? Can either of you share some backstory of this character? Either made up or, Ty, do you have an official canon backstory for him?
Well, I think we've given a pretty good backstory that Bern has internalized. Go ahead, tell him your backstory.
Yeah, it's nice to start this new season with landing on a new planet, because Murtry is head of security for the RCE, essentially the tip of the spear for this exploratory, you know, mission really to this new planet to find out what's there, to take control of the situation. There is also this issue that there are belters there already, and Murtry needs to get rid of them, really. So he's a man with a mission, an ex-military man, or, you know, a man of military standing. And, it's great sort of landing on this new planet, and he is the officer there, really in charge of Earth's contingency from the RCE.
And he's sort of set down in the middle of chaos because of the shuttle exploding. And I think that lends sort of like an urgency to him that he's like, I really need to get control of this now.
I think you're spot on. It's immediately a disaster scenario. He's lost men and women, which obviously for a military man is tantamount to failure. You know, he very quickly needs to get control of the situation, find out what happened, who did it, and punish them, and to take appropriate actions for that. Yeah, it's definitely a disaster situation, yeah.
You and I talked briefly about this before, and, you know, of perhaps most bad guys don't see themselves as bad guys. On The Expanse in general, in The Expanse universe, the idea of a bad guy, I think, is always kind of complicated. And obviously, Murtry does not see himself as a bad guy. How do you think about him?
Yeah, it's a great point. I always thought he was a man of a man who worked out which loyalty had the most personal advantages. Again, sorry to harken back to the military thing, but, you know, he's a man who's been a company man for a long time. He is an Earther, obviously. He's from Earth. He is a bigot against the Belters, particularly. And I think he's a motivated man, seeing if he can get his big payday, really, in this particular scenario. But yeah, I don't think he sees himself as a bad man at all. He's an intelligent man, thinks things through, and takes action.
I mean, he makes a valid point when he says that, you know, he'd already lost 30 people by the time he touched the ground. So someone else drew first blood. So when he takes extreme action to protect his remaining crew, you know, he feels fully justified in doing that. And I think he has an argument to make.
When I was thinking about this in preparation to talking to y'all, I see these points totally. And I understand how he must be seeing this, especially sort of the chaos and disaster aspect of it, how that would kind of heighten his desire to just have some order, because he probably associates order with survival, right? Like, you can't just like have things willy-nilly and expect people to get out of here alive.
Well, it's also taking advantage of the chaos. You know, I feel uncomfortable making constant comparisons to Halliburton, but in those situations where there is this chaos in a war environment, and then that's where the money's made. You know, that's where the natural resources can be coerced and controlled. You know, there is these moments of opportunity at these times of ultimate chaos that I think men like Murtry are very good at exploiting for their paymasters. And it does have that feel about it, this particular landing on this new planet, you know.
Perhaps Blackwater in addition
to
Halliburton. Ty, were you thinking about those things when you created this storyline?
No, not them particularly, although I think that's certainly a good, it's a good parallel. What I was thinking about mostly was the Western expansion in the United States and the Transcontinental Railroad. And the ways in which the railroad used their laying their tracks as a way to just grab land, and just you know, that sort of that manifest destiny and eminent domain argument that they had of everything 100 yards in either direction on either side of the railroad track we lay belongs to us. Yeah, irrespective of who lives there, you know, the native peoples, settlers, it didn't matter. They just grabbed up everything. And the violence that accompanied that, because, you know, the railroads hired very dangerous people to enforce their will as they moved across the country. And you know, a lot of people were killed as those tracks were laid down and as that land was grabbed. That's, you know, that's really, for us, the closest parallel to it.
I've heard other people observe that this season does have a Western feel to it, that it feels like we're in Tombstone a little bit on Illis. Do you have that sense for Byrne? Is he a character in a Western, or is he out of some other genre?
The actual quarry itself has this sort of stark, very sort of base nature feel about it, like some of those Monument Valley and Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns. You know, they have these like these vast vast areas and the people look tiny within them. And yeah, it did have a Western feel to it. There's a lot of shots where me and Amos in particular sort of looking at each other over the, you know, over the settlement. And there's, you know, it's just long kind of looks. Yes, it did have a Western feeling about it, and a kind of gunslinger atmosphere as well. Everyone is armed. Everyone is pulling guns a lot of the time. There is this sort of heightened threat situation at all times. And I think that actually helped me, you know, realise Mercury's character in the fact that it's not a wartime scenario, but it's certainly one of high alert at all times. And in some ways, he is justified when he accuses the Belters of killing his people and making trouble. You know, he's on high alert.
Yeah, and actually, that brings me sort of maybe, I don't know, Ty, if this is a parallel or not, which is that, to me, the one place where kind of the Western expansion parallel might be modified a little bit is the intense dangers of this planet, which I feel like in American history, at least my understanding of the American expansion, there was sort of like, well, it's the Wild West, but it's land that we will tame. There's like this intense confidence on the part of the white people, right? We're just going to go out, we're going to get our land, and we're going to be there. And they were wrong sometimes, right? Like winters were horrid and all of that. But there was sort of an assumption that this land is ours to claim.
Yes.
And Illis, there's some very, you know, prominent evidence that that's not the case.
Well, I mean, I've been talking a lot about the first Europeans to show up in Australia. Mm. The dangers of that place were not understood. And a whole lot of people died when they showed up there because, you know, I mean, what is it, like 6 of the 10 most poisonous things on Earth live in Australia. You got 25-foot saltwater crocodiles and sharks everywhere. I mean, it's for a pre-industrial society or the age of sail society. It's a dangerous place, and even getting there was incredibly dangerous. You know, dangerous waters you had to cross, but they went anyway because there was silver and there was the possibility of wealth to be pulled out of that place, and so any amount of danger was okay as long as, you know, somebody might get rich out of it. And I think there is that feeling as well, that it doesn't matter that it's dangerous. It doesn't matter that some people are going to die because somebody's going to get rich, and everybody always thinks it's going to be them.
Is that why the Belters are there, though? It's not just about getting rich for them.
Well, they certainly, that was not initially why they went there. They initially went there because it was a refugee crisis and there was nowhere for them to land. They just took a chance to grab something for themselves. Once they got there and they realized there was gold in Thumbdar Hills, now suddenly it becomes like, oh, you know, maybe this can really pay off for us. Maybe this isn't just a place to, you know, to live so that we don't die in space. And now suddenly they're looking at like, maybe we can pull a lot of wealth out of here and actually build something for ourselves in a way that we haven't been able to before. I think that the story about what you're doing there certainly changes once you realize that there's money.
Mm. Well, let's pull back a little bit to the other side of the Western expansion, the Eastern Edge, I guess it would be Earth and Mars for that matter. But it seems like, you know, Mercury's loyalties are to Earth in particular. How do you think Earthers are understanding this Western expansion? Is it a similar thing to Manifest Destiny? I mean, there's sort of some different points of view. Some people seem
I think
how dangerous it is.
The answer to that and the most telling answer is that Earth starts giving out charters to these new mm-hmm. worlds. And the Belter position is, why do they have the right to give out charters? Why does Earth assume that it owns every world beyond the rings? Because Earth is certainly acting like it assumes it owns them all.
And they also, it seems like, somewhat cavalier about these dangers too, right? Like it's just about we deserve this outward expansion and we have all these. I mean, one of the things I appreciate about the expanse in general is that the other side is always kind of given fair hearing, that there's no debate or argument, that you don't hear what the counter is. And I feel like, you know, they don't talk a lot about life on Earth some, you know, we spend a lot of our time in space or Mars or the belt or Illis. But this idea that there are, you know, thousands of people whose existence is defined by being on basic, right, which is like a form of welfare, and that they deserve some kind of new expansion, that seems like a good argument to me when I hear it from that point of view.
I was also thinking that with Mercury and the RCE, I'm pretty sure that they've done this lots of times, but also that it's almost a secret. It's not a secret mission, is it? But it's certainly, again, I keep saying tip of the spear, but it's like the first exploratory tentacle sent out by Earth to this, through the ring, to this particular planet. But this is the process that they intend to keep going as well. I imagine there are lots of other Mercuries out there going to, you know, as each planet gets explored, then exploited by the Earth. Mercury himself is, yes, an Earther through and through. It's interesting for me to see the debate with Avarasarala, sorry.
And I have trouble with it, too.
Yeah, I know. It's been a long day, you know. But her conversations with Holden saying, you know, what the fuck is going on? I cannot have this blowing up. I cannot have this becoming an issue. I need you to keep this quiet. I need you to control this, you know.
Going along with what Bern is just saying there, you know, RC isn't sent to mine Illis. It is sent as a scientific exploratory mission. But there, I mean, that has been true here on Earth, that very often the companies that do these scientific expeditions are also energy extraction companies. And so they, you know, under the guise of we're going to do this scientific exploration, part of what they're hoping to get out of it is the right to extract resources. So RC is going there ostensibly strictly for a scientific mission to study the planet and determine what dangers there might be. But of course, there's also the hope that for the company, once the gates are open to resource extraction, they'll get the first contract. So, you know, you go out and you have a mission that is, it has the best, on paper, the best intentions, but there's always that monetary incentive hiding inside of it.
I was thinking about, this is kind of maybe off topic, but I was just thinking about the other way that colonists sort of treated the New Worlds had to do with the spreading of religion. And I wonder if there's a kind of religion of capitalism happening, at least with RC. Like, we are going to bring this certain kind of extractive capitalism here. This is how it's going to be. And I don't know. I mean, it's not that the Belters aren't capitalists exactly, but they are resisting the kind of top-down culture, at the very least, that Earth is bringing them. Do you think it's just a competition for resources, or is it a competition of cultures, too?
It's both, of course. RC comes, and they have a very sort of, as you said, top-down, a very authority-driven and legalistic argument. You know, Mercury often talks about the fact that he has a charter. He has legal authority to do the things that he's doing, and expects that to have weight, whereas the Belters are a very different type of society. You know, they have an administrator, the Carol Chiwewe character, but she's never treated like she's the governor or she's the mayor of the town. It's much more treated as a sort of a consensus community, which matches more closely what we've seen with the Belters in the other places we've seen Belters. So there is a conflict of cultures there. That you know, RC shows up and says, we have authority granted to us by a piece of paper. And the Belters are going, why does that piece of paper matter? And why should we listen to the people who wrote it?
And of course, sort of at the crisis of in the middle of the season, they're somewhat forced to act together, right? The planet is rebelling against occupation, it seems like. And there was a part of me when I was watching the panicked, you know, sort of rush to the alien structures that they're going to hide in, that they have to literally work together, right, to get inside and to create some kind of escape route for themselves. And part of me was like, oh, you know what, this could be like, there could be a kumbaya moment here if this was that kind of show where people realize, oh, we have a greater enemy and that's what we should do. But that I'm pretty sure is not going to happen. You know, under pressure, humans can change, right? And this is going to create great pressure on the units here. But I guess also they can go further into their tribes. Is that what the cleaving that's going to happen here?
You know, Byrne can speak to this as well, because it's a point his character brings up quite often this season, that they are 6 months from any help. So when you're looking at, like, this is how many boxes of protein bars we have, and when we divide by the number of people, here's how many days we can all eat. Suddenly the math becomes very clear. And who is in the group that you're going to share your protein bars with and who is outside of that group becomes very important math. And I think more than anything else, what Murtry is a pragmatist. And he's doing that math.
Yeah. There is also the added, well, an incredible thing that there is alien tech on the planet.
That's right.
You know, it wasn't necessarily going to be the case, and that there is suddenly this extremely complex ancient tech, which, you know, if monetized right, could change everyone's lives. And it's interesting to see how everyone responds to that, how Holden responds to that, how Murtry responds to that. You know, it really is there's obviously so much potential on this planet, and everyone is looking for the ways of exploiting and controlling that, particularly Murtry anyway.
That's true. And I guess the contrast I'm thinking of is that, like, when, you know, Earth was about to get hit with a alien artifact, Mars and Earth and the Belt kind of had to band together. There was a recognition of this greater enemy, but that's fallen apart on this planet. And I guess it's because everyone is everyone's sort of shifted a frame of mind to extraction and to profit rather than mere survival, even though survival is right on the line. See, I keep thinking again, this is, I guess I'm the Pollyanna here, because I keep thinking, like, oh, but they could work together. But it's true that there's only so many protein bars. But they're just not going to see that. Murtry's not going to see that. Is it because of profit, though, or is it because of his loyalties? It seems to me, from the way you've been talking about him, that on some level, in the way that he's not a bad guy, he really is loyal. Like, he really has an idea of his team. That's who he's thinking of.
Agreed. I can't help but think it's a slight microcosm of human nature, though, isn't it? It you know, in a new situation, you do divide into tribes, and you do work out what the natural resources are to eat and how you survive, that kind of very sort of, you know, basic instincts, very, very sort of primal. And I think that is what happens, especially as the season goes on and there's, you know, they're working under duress and everything. I think we revert back to sort of our base natures, and we divide to conquer, as it were.
You know, I think a lot about the different sort of larger themes that The Expanse has explored, and one that was very powerful, you know, in an earlier season was the refugee crisis, right? Sort of very explicit kind of imagery of the people, of the Belter refugees, or sorry, Ganymede refugees, who I guess are Belters, having a feel, the same kind of feel as looking at the Syrian refugees. And here, in this season, I was thinking about border crossing when I thought about the Ring Gates. And thinking about the idea of the Belters who were so determined to cross into what they hoped would be a better life that they were willing, they say, shoot at us if you're going to do it. We are so willing to do this. We are willing to die to get to this place that we're going to go. We want to be where we think we'll have a better life.
Well, their option is to die in space. You know, what we were deliberately pulling from is. In World War II, the ship full of Jewish refugees who were fleeing Europe, ahead of Germany, and once they got on the ship, suddenly found that no one would let them no one would let them disembark. So they're out on this ship. They're running low on supplies and food, and nobody wants to take them. So it's very deliberately mirroring that you know, you've got these people who got off of Ganymede after a war situation. They're on these ships. They have limited supplies. They're trying to find some place to go, and nobody wants to let them land. Mm. Because nobody wants a whole ship full of new mouths to feed. Hundreds of people with nothing to bring and only going to be an additional burden on the resources. If you're in a desperate situation like that, if your choice is die gasping for air in space, mm-hmm. all of you, or maybe a few of you can make a run past the border and survive, suddenly, you know, that becomes a pretty easy choice.
Yeah.
And maybe the harder choice and the fill up on that situation is the people that shoot that ship down are also belters.
Yeah.
It's pretty intense. I remember I got a little, it got to me, that scene, thinking about the power of a feeling you had to do that. I mean, you explain. I think the logic is that there's an even bigger cause here. And that we have signed this treaty with these other entities, and we, in order to survive as an entire culture, we're going to have to just do this. I mean, I can't think of an analog to that in history.
Well, I mean, this is happening in the shadow of what was an existential threat to all of humanity. And the assumption is that there will be dangers on the other side of those rings that could bring that threat back. And when the choice is a few of us die or all of us die, people will take pretty extreme measures.
See, that's what I keep going back to on the planet. Like, I keep going back to, like, the alien artifacts are going to kill you all. Why, you know, you should see again, I'm the Pollyanna that wants people to work together. But I have one more question about the alien artifacts, which is that is also something that's slightly different in the parallel between the Western expansion and what's happening beyond the ring gates. And that's that the environment is, you talked about Australia being deadly, but this is a much more kind of focused kind of malevolence, let's say. It's artifacts of a specific culture. And I wonder if there's some sort of message here about the way that environment fights back. Maybe this is just going back to the Australia example, but that when we try to be extractive without thinking about it, there are unintended consequences that can be deadly.
I don't know that I see anything on Illis as being particularly malevolent. I think what it is it's dangerous and misunderstood. I think the vast desert at the center of Australia that a lot of people went into and died, I don't think that desert cared about killing people. I think it was just big and dry and very dangerous. And I see Illis in largely the same way. There's a lot of dangerous stuff there. I don't think it necessarily wants to kill humans. I think just by its nature, it is dangerous to humans, and we don't understand it.
I was talking to someone else today who said that one thing that you've said about the protomolecule is it's the rock that people break themselves on. Is that the quote?
Yeah.
And maybe I'm doing that there myself by describing it as malevolent. It's hard. I think it's human to want to describe motives to things. And that maybe that's something that's sort of interesting at the heart of the show, that there is something that is genuinely just exists and has a purpose, but it's not a good or bad purpose. It is not good or evil. It's not malevolent. It's a thing. But I keep on wanting to say that it has a purpose or a motive.
In season three, when Ashford and Holden talk about the protomolecule, and as they're sitting there near the ring gates inside that ring space, Holden even says it's just trying to build a road. It doesn't want to kill us, but we're like an anthill. And when the paving machine comes by and lays down blacktop, all the ants in the anthill are going to die. The person driving the paving machine never even knows that happened. That person doesn't hate ants. Their goal is not to kill ants. We just happen to be in the way. With these vast technologies and these incredibly powerful and dangerous technologies, there doesn't have to be any malevolence to it. The fact of its existence is dangerous to us because we don't understand it.
This sort of gets me a segue back to Murtry, because it goes back to this idea that I opened with, which is it seems like in The Expanse, there's nothing that is purely good or bad. There's no purely good or bad character, purely good or bad motivation. So I wanted to get back to you, Byrne, in wrapping up here. What is the thing you're most excited for people to see in this season, in your character?
In my character specifically, I don't know. As an actor, obviously, you try and be as truthful as possible and work with what you're given and juggle and try and come up with something complex and interesting to watch. Perhaps I could comment on what I'm excited as a fan, seeing the other characters who we've come to learn to love, going through new situations. I love seeing Naomi land on a planet. You know, what it does to her body. What are the sort of physical restrictions? You know, how everyone reacts to this atmosphere. You know, things which we obviously take for granted, but, you know, just the feeling of fresh oxygen into one's lungs, you know, these kind of very natural, primal things. For me, it's nice to see the characters in a new scenario, you know, and again, there is a great momentum straight from the very beginning. There's this explosion, and there's this emergency, this disaster, and, you know, that means that we really hit the ground running, and obviously that has a great, you know, momentum starting off. So, yeah, I'm just really excited to share it, really, and I hope everyone really enjoys it as much as I did.
So Byrne's not going to toot his own horn, so I'm going to toot it for him.
Please do.
Murtry is as close to a pure foil for our core cast as maybe we've had on the show. He has some scenes with Naomi, he has some scenes with Holden, and he has some scenes with Amos that I think are some of the most fun confrontation scenes that we've had on the show. And each of the three of them interacts with him in a different way, but all three of them, when banging up against the sort of immovable rock that is Murtry, get some of the best moments of the season.
I was thinking as I watched the episode that I've seen that at first I thought he was like the anti-Holden, and that I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Like in every way, he's opposite of Holden. And then I thought, no, he's the anti-Amos. I feel like that's pretty good. Like that scene where Amos confronts him about being a killer.
No, there's something quite refreshing about that, isn't there? In life, when somebody calls you on you recognize that somebody recognizes you. However you're trying to hide it. So yeah, I love doing that scene.
And that is going to resolve in a very unexpected way. I think we have got some great surprises at the end of the season. Because you watch those moments and you sort of write the ending for it in your head, and that is, I think people are going to be taken by surprise on how those things resolve.
I believe you, and we won't do any spoilers. I will say I agree that sense of almost relief that one gets when you're recognized. That's what I got from that scene between them, was the being able to relax a bit about being called out for who you are. Yes, that is who I am. I don't have to pretend otherwise with you. There's an intimacy to it, almost.
But also, don't mess with me.
Well, yeah, yeah. But being seen is the thing that people want. Like, that's a class, that's what makes us human, is this idea to be recognized for who we are. That's why, to me, that scene was, like, weirdly intimate. Like, even in the way that it was shot and like done in the middle of this saloon atmosphere, but it's the two of them. It's almost like, I want to say like, it's almost like a date, like looking into each other's eyes and recognizing
each other. Yeah, strange, complex date in a dive bar. Yeah, I've been on a few of those, I can tell you.
All right, well, Ty, you've bragged on Byrne. Maybe I should ask, I was going to ask you about what you're excited for people to see, but maybe if we do the tradition, but Byrne's already talked about the show in general, so I'm going to ask you. You have to brag on at least the show or at least some other things that we can look forward to coming up in the season.
Maybe I think I talked about my favorite thing, the watching our core cast, our core crew, bang up against Murtry. I think that's a wonderful as Amos would call it, a wonderful churn. the other story too is seeing Vassarala in a situation she's never been in before, where suddenly she has to care about public opinion and has a legitimate threat to her control in Nancy Gao. I think that story plays out very interestingly, of course, across the course of the season. And then watching Bobby get tossed into uncertain waters. You know, I mean, when all of what she self-identified as is taken away from her, her identity as a Marine, her identity as a patriot, when all of that is stripped away, you know, how she finds her way back to herself is a really interesting path. So, I mean, I'm excited for everybody to see all that stuff.
Yes, maybe I should. Maybe that's a dumb question. I will say that the episode 6 of Bobby's arc, like, broke my heart, basically.
She's not done. She's got more stuff to do.
I know, but it's still, like, the way that she has, she has some things in common with Naomi in terms of, like, her own determinedness, like, her unwillingness to admit defeat ever, right? And her belief in herself, and also, I guess, a little bit like Naomi, her belief in, you know, higher ideals and dedication to those things beyond her own comfort. And to see her try to do the right thing over and over and over and get turned away, or have her belief in someone else's principles be disappointed, it's hard to watch. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say hard to watch. It's great. It's great TV. But in a show that has a lot of interesting explorations of darkness, like, that's actually something that really got to me. Like, just to have your ideals kind of chipped away at. But you say she's not done. There's ideals yet in her future.
Oh, her journey's not over.
That's it for the show. Again, if you have not seen the show, go watch it. If you have not subscribed to this podcast, subscribe to it. We will have individual episode recaps coming very soon. A couple of more interviews before that. Until then.